The show is called Live and Local. It's your connection to local music and more. And we're made possible by the Champaign-Urbana Symphony presenting the CUS Oak Holiday Concert on Wednesday, December 1st at 7:30 in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Ring in the holidays with this Champaign-Urbana family tradition. My guest on the show today is Gail Sherwood McGee, who is a professor of musicology at the University of Illinois. And she has a book with the University of Illinois Press called Charles Ives Reconsidered, described by the press as an engaging reassessment of the seminal American composer. So we're going to explore a few things, certainly what makes him American, why he needs to be reassessed, and share a lot of music of his, some of which I think might surprise you if you have a certain image of Charles Ives. The book is recently out in paperback. And we'll have Gail McGee with us very shortly here on FM 90.9. That was clarinetist Richard Stoltzman with pianist Richard Good in music by Charles Ives, an arrangement of one of his songs called In the Morning, and heard here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Let's see, I've just handed another tornado watch. So let me read this for you. Tornado watch is now effective until 6 p.m. Central Time. That's no change. However, the following areas in Illinois, we've added some counties in Central Illinois. we're still talking about McLean in our listening area, but there's others pretty nearby. Logan, Sangamon, Marshall, Menard, Tazewell, Mason, Peoria, and Woodford. Some of those not in our listening area, but nonetheless, that includes the cities of Bloomington, Galesburg, Havana, Jacksonville, Lincoln, Normal, Peoria, and Springfield. That tornado watch in effect until 6 o'clock this evening. Oh, wait, there's a second piece of paper in my hand. That's just an update of the forecast, which we'll give later on. My guest on this, not only on this portion of the show, but for the whole show today, is Gail McGee. She's professor at the University of Illinois in the School of Music, and has this book that's been out for a little while, Charles Ives Reconsidered, recently out in paperback with University of Illinois Press. And I imagine that our listeners have certain, those of you who even know who Charles Ives is may well have certain preconceptions, a lot of which are quite true. But then there's a lot of there's other sides of Charles Ives. He was a really interesting character. Gail, thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Happy to be here.
So what interests you about Charles Ives in general? Or what interested you in the first place enough to write a book about him?
Well, I think there were two things that attracted me to Ives's music initially. One was that he was the first composer that I studied at university who seemed to have a sense of humor. Not that Bach isn't a funny guy or Beethoven isn't a funny guy, but with Ives, he really had a sense of humor about writing his music and a sense of humor that came through in his own writings. That really appealed to me initially. The second thing that really appealed to me was the fact that I recognized many of the sources in Ives's music. And those were the hymn tunes. At going to university and studying European classical music, I didn't hear a lot of music that I knew from my own background. And suddenly, with Ives's music, with his symphonies particularly, I heard hymn tunes that I recognized from growing up in my father's church. My father was a Baptist minister. And when I heard something like the Sweet By and By in Ives's symphonies or his songs, I recognized it as my music. It was the first time that I'd heard my music in a European context.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Canada. I grew up in a small town outside of, I grew up in Toronto for part of the time, and then other times in a small town called Grimsby, Ontario. And I went to university at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario.
And obviously mistakenly think of some of these tunes, some of these hymn tunes, as American hymn tunes. Which,
that's right. You know. No, well, I'm really fascinated with Ives's position as an American composer. I think that maybe being Canadian gives me a special insight into what makes him American.
How so?
Because I think that some of the things that are maybe taken for granted in the United States by Americans regarding Ives it's something that I'm interested in, such as the hymn tunes. These hymn tunes, in fact, are North American. Some of them are transatlantic. Some of them have English origins, but they're grouped together as something that is American. Well, what makes them American? The fact that they're performed in the United States, published in the United States? Is there a certain American character? When we talk about the freedom of Ives's music, is that something that's specifically American? Well, there are a lot of other countries that have freedom, too. I'm particularly interested as well in how Ives treated the wars in his lifetime, the First World War particularly, because the United States has a very different view. There was a very different understanding of the First World War in the United States than in Canada or in Britain, for example. And looking at the kinds of pieces that he wrote during the First World War, I just found it very interesting to see that perspective.
And he died in 1954, so he
did.
Covered both of those wars easily, without being too old to understand them, or too young for that matter, born in 1874.
Well, that's true. And actually, the Civil War was very important in his life, too. Even though he was born 9 years after the end of it, his father was a band leader in the Union Army. And so Ives inherited a tremendous amount of the Civil War musical repertoire from his dad, and he constantly reused it through his life.
Well, and didn't his dad end up being a bandmaster in his town, too?
He did. That's right. He led a number of bands, including a Salvation Army band.
Which was a huge bands and things, again, that we often think of as American, figured all the way through his music. Baseball, I mentioned in the promo.
Absolutely.
To this. He was a big baseball fan. And what other kinds of things about Ives personally seem quintessentially American, maybe?
Well, I think the fact that he went to Yale and the position of Yale, he studied at Yale from 1894 to 98, and his instructor was Horatio Parker, who was very well known during his time. He hasn't remained very well known since he died in 1919, but he was Ives's main professor at Yale. And the position of Yale in the late 19th century and the development of a music program there, I found that very interesting because Horatio Parker really created the music program at Yale, and Ives was one of the first graduates under Parker, looking at that curriculum and thinking about how we teach music, how we understand music, again, and Yale as this great American institution that was also grappling with, well, what is it to be American? How do we study American music when, in fact, at that point, there was very little of what we would think of as an American classical tradition. Most of it was European. I think Ives deals with issues of American identity throughout his life, and particularly in contrast to European repertoire and European music.
For example?
Concord Sonata, Third Symphony, Second Symphony, most of the songs that we're going to hear today, the chamber music, you mention it, you name it pretty much, and you'll see something that is dealing with American versus European identity.
Well, we have a song queued up here called The Two Little Flowers.
Yeah.
In what way is this an example of that?
Well, if you think of the old sort of European romantic leader, think of Schubert and Schumann, think of images of flowers and feminine beauty. Ives updates this in a song that was written for his daughter, Edith. And he wrote this in the 1920s. He and his wife, Harmony Twitchell Ives, wrote this, actually. And what they do is they take that imagery of feminine beauty and flowers, and it's a little quirky. You'll hear it. The rhythm is a little quirky, but it's really an update of that older model, the European flower song.
So Harmony wrote the words?
Harmony wrote the words. Probably she and Ives wrote them together. They're credited to her, and then Charles wrote the music, and it's dedicated to Edith and her friend Susanna.
And we're hearing Jan de Gattani?
Yes, and Gilbert Kalish.
Gilbert Kalish on the piano. Charles Ives' music here on Live and Local. Jan Dagatani with pianist Gilbert Kalish, music by Charles Ives, Two Little Flowers. And the songs of his are not, well, I was going to say they're uniformly beautiful and touching. There's some that are just weird, but that's an example of many that I've heard.
Gorgeous. It's a beautiful piece of music, and it's incredibly well written. I think I'm so glad that you introduced this program with the image of Ives as kind of someone who can set people off. People, I think, often have that reaction to Ives, especially if they know some of the more experimental works, the more radical works. It can be music that is working often, pushing the limits of the tonal system or working outside of the tonal system. Ives did that. He did it really well. He was very progressive. He anticipated a lot of the innovations that would happen during the 20th century. And yet he could also write wonderfully beautiful tonal music when he wanted to. That song that you just heard is from the 1920s. It's from very late in his career.
Very late in his career, meaning that he stopped writing.
He stopped writing at the end of the 1920s. Yes, well before he died. He did have to do a lot of work getting his compositions ready for performance and publication. He did that in the 1930s, but he had terrible problems with his eyesight, and it was very difficult for him to work on his manuscripts past about 1929. In fact, In the Morning, I think, which you just played before we started, that's credited as his last composition from 1929.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I did not realize that.
There you go.
Inadvertently chosen as far as that one. I just like the tune.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Did he major in music? I mean, what focus on music at Yale? Because that's not what he did professionally.
No, that's true. Actually, he could not major in music. You could not major in music at Yale at that time. So he had a general degree, but he did take every music course possible. And in fact, those were the only courses that he got anywhere above a C. He had a gentleman's C average, which was really a D average. But in music, he did very, very well.
So what did he end up doing when he finished college?
He went to work in New York City in the insurance industry. And in fact, he formed a very, very successful company in insurance. It sold insurance. It was affiliated with Mutual of New York. And he revolutionized the way that life insurance was sold. And in fact, he never sold policies himself. But he and his partner, Mike Myrick, created a company that worked to sell, worked to train agents and to sell policies for Mutual, and it was very successful. It's credited in insurance histories of the insurance industry as being very innovative.
Wow, and he stayed in that for most of his life, didn't he?
Well, he retired in 1929. He did that too. Yeah, but I've questioned this in my book, and some other writers have questioned how much he was spending, how much time he was spending actually at the insurance business in the 1920s. He was probably composing more than working.
But he was successful enough in the insurance business that he did just fine retiring.
Oh, he did
plenty early.
Well. I think he's one of the few millionaire composers. And what was great about Ives is that he remembered what it was like to be on the other side, to be a musician or composer, performer in the United States without support. And he was incredibly generous to other musicians and composers through his later life. People like John Cage, Lou Harrison. There are a number of American composers who benefited. Henry Cowell is another one.
And a lot of them attribute a lot of their influence to him, particularly some of the more progressive aspects of his composition, right?
Definitely. I think Ives is seen as the father of American experimental music, and that cuts both ways. Again, it gives this image of Ives as being just an experimental, radical composer, which isn't necessarily fair to all of his other output because he had tremendous range and depth and variety. But on the other hand, I think American composers really wanted someone from the United States who could serve as that figure, as the father of experimental music in this country, who was from the United States and trained exclusively in this country.
His people kind of had to discover him by accident.
No,
if
that's
I remember.
Not true.
No?
No. It's good that you say that, because that was the narrative for a long time, but Ives was actually working very hard to get his music out. He published it himself. He published the first few collections himself because he had the financial ability to do so. In the 1920s, he published the 114 songs and the Concord Sonata, and he sent copies of those out all across the country. Later in the decade, he paid to have orchestras perform his music. He paid to have Henry Cowell publish his music in the New Musical Quarterly. So there were there were many efforts from Ives directly and then from other people who were supporting him to get his music out there.
I just had this image of, you know, this guy toiling away in insurance and, you know, sort of in the backwoods somewhere composing. And
Grandma Moses of music.
Yeah. Right? Not true. Huh?
No, not at all.
Well, that's good to know. I want to ask you about some of the experiments in a little bit, but let's hear another song of his. This one is called Memories, and it's interesting. It's part A and part B.
Right.
Very pleasant and rather sad, and those titles almost sort of express some of the simplicity of Ives or the plainness of Ives. Does this also come from his own texts or with harmony or
some, these are his own texts.
Yeah, most of his songs are, aren't they?
Yes, he wrote a lot of them, and he was very active in sort of editing and abridging other people's texts as well.
Anything else to say about this before we hear it?
No, I think we should talk about it after we hear it.
Oh, all right. Then Jan DeGatani, once again, mezzo-soprano, pianist Gilbert Kalish, here on Live and Local. My guest is Gail McGee, author of Charles Ives Reconsidered.
We're sitting in the opera house, we're waiting for the curtain to arise, the thunderstorm rise. We're feeling pretty gay as well we may. Oh, Jimmy, look, I say the band is tuning up and soon we'll start to play. We whistle and we hum, in time with the rip. We're sitting in the opera house, waiting for the curtain to arise, the windows for rise, a feeling of expectancy, a certain kind of ecstasy, expectancy and ecstasy, expectancy and ecstasy. Shh. Curtain!
Incredible contrast between parts A and part B of Memories. Very pleasant and then rather sad. Jan DeGatani singing with pianist Gilbert Kalish. Music by Charles Ives here on Live and Local. And my guest is Gail McGee, who's written this book called Charles Ives Reconsidered. So, okay, we were going to talk about it afterwards.
Right. So let's talk about it, Kevin.
Yeah. What was I couldn't even get most of those words in the first part. It sounded like a Gilbert and Sullivan patter song.
Exactly. It's a patter song. Yes, exactly. And like so many of Ives's songs, it's a song about music, and it's a song about musical performance. It's about sitting in the opera house waiting for the show to start. But of course, it's a song about sitting and waiting for music to start. And in that Gilbert and Sullivan patter song, later taken up by musical theater as well.
So this predated Gilbert and Sullivan? I don't remember when they
were
around.
It's later than Gilbert and Sullivan. That's probably the model for it. But I'm thinking that the patter song is taken up in musical theater as well, later in the 20s and 30s. That's what I'm thinking of. But it's such a fun piece. You can almost imagine Ives cackling as he writes this very difficult piece of music. And I think it says, I can't remember, I think on the music it says, as fast as possible. And Jan DeGatani does an amazing job because she has to whistle at one point. She has to stop singing and start whistling. It's just hilarious.
I don't know how you'd sing it any faster. And then the rather sad part.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually queuing up the next CD while instead of paying attention to the words.
Okay. Well, do you want to see them?
Yeah, let me see the words. What was he sad about?
It's a portrait of a memory of, he says, his uncle, who is humming as he walks down to the town or to the barn. And it's a ragged old little tune that's beloved in his memory because it's connected to his uncle. Actually, there's a great biography of Ives by Stuart Fader, and he makes a big deal about that figure not being Ives's uncle, in fact, being Ives's father, who was, again, the caretaker, the keeper of this 19th century American tradition, popular song, patriotic tunes, who was very much about making music at an amateur level with people who loved music, not doing it in the concert hall, not doing it with this very Europeanized background or not doing it as a profession, but doing it for love, amateur in the best sense of the word. And that sad memory, I think, is of Ives's own father, who died in 1894, just about a month after Ives started at Yale. When Ives was very young, he was only 20 years old. Mm. He had just celebrated his 20th birthday.
You know, I'm looking at the text of the first part of the song, since it did go by so fast.
And yeah.
It seemed like this one middle section of it is has a lot to do with so much of his music. The band is tuning up, and soon we'll start to play. We whistle and we hum, beat time with the drum, and then the refrain, we're sitting in the opera house.
Right.
And the next music we have is from this huge piece of his, mm-hmm. which I actually did get to hear somebody play live once. I think it was Frederick Hrushevsky, maybe.
Wow.
The Concord Sonata. And that's one of those pieces that really helped create his reputation as being an incredibly out there composer.
Absolutely.
But the movement that you've chosen from it, and all of them were referencing some of the Alcotts and the other writers in Massachusetts, mostly.
Emerson, Hawthorne, and Thoreau. Yes, the Transcendentalist group in Concord, Massachusetts. The subtitle, it's Sonata Number 2. The subtitle is Concord, Massachusetts, 1840 to 1860. Now, Ives wrote this probably during the First World War. Most of what we know of this piece was written between about 1916 and 1918. He had worked over parts of it before then. But it was, again, looking back to the so-called Concord School, and each movement is named after an individual, Emerson, Hawthorne, or Thoreau. This movement is named after the Alcott family, Bronson Alcott and Louise May Alcott, his daughter. What I like about this, I mean, this I think is the most accessible movement of the Concord Sonata. The rest is a beast of a piece. I mean, it's just huge. It's so difficult to play. And it really does exemplify this image of Ives that we have as being very experimental, of working really against the boundaries of the traditional piano sonata. But in the Alcotts, he takes two pieces of music and collapses them. One is a piece called The Missionary Chant. It's from 1832. And it's
his
going to start
tune.
Out. No, it's actually a published hymn tune. Mm. And it's an American hymn tune. And he combines that with Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And the reason he does that is because they start the same. The phrase, opening phrase for both, is very, very similar. Da, 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 da. That's how the hymn tune starts. It's also the beginning of the symphony. And I think this is where you hear sort of the battle between European classical music and American hymn tune or amateur music. And they're being played on the piano. I sort of make a big deal out of this because when Ives was growing up, he couldn't just go out and hear Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. The way that you heard symphonic music in the late 19th century and even into the 20th century in this country was that you played it on the piano. You played piano reductions and piano transcriptions. And so when you hear the piano playing the Fifth Symphony in this, that is not just Ives boiling down that piece that we all know now from the orchestral version. It's actually representative of a whole tradition of performance. And Louise May Alcott would have played it on the piano as well. And so what he does is he takes this European classical music canonic work, combines it with an American hymn tune. Sometimes they get along, sometimes they don't, which I think is significant during the First World War at that time. But ultimately, he reconciles both of them.
And then as the movement goes on, it starts to go a little more out there,
mm-hmm.
but nowhere near as far out as some of the other movements, which can really be just huge masses of tone clusters, and
yes.
It sounds like somebody leaning their elbow on the piano and or their whole arm, and I don't know how anybody could learn that piece, much less memorize it.
I know, I have tremendous respect. And actually, the performance we're going to hear is Ives himself. He recorded this in 1943, and I think it shows Ives's ability as a pianist. He was a pianist and an organist. He was a church organist for over a decade, starting when he was about 15 and going into 1902. But he was a very, very good keyboardist, and we're going to hear him play the Alcotts himself on the piano, which I think is kind of interesting.
It's from the Concord Sonata, Sonata Number 2 for piano by Charles Ives. Charles Ives playing. My guest, Gail McGee, here on Live and Local. Charles Ives himself playing his music called The Alcotts, a movement from his Sonata Number 2 for piano called the Concord Sonata, nicknamed the Concord Sonata. Well, it's not nicknamed. That's essentially what he called it. Concord, Massachusetts,
1840 to 1860, that's the subtitle. But it's often just called The Concord Sonata.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's his full title. And my guest on Live and Local today is Gail McGee, author of Charles Ives Reconsidered, recently out in paperback. You can get it through University of Illinois Press, and I'm sure through many other places as well. Our show today is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information is at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. I want to repeat that the National Weather Service has issued a tornado watch in effect until 6 p.m. this evening for the following areas in Illinois. Watch includes these counties in central Illinois: McLean in our immediate severe weather coverage area, but also Logan, Sangamon, Marshall, Menard, Tazewell, Mason, Peoria, Woodford, if you happen to be driving through any of those places. And cities include Bloomington, Galesburg, Havana, Jacksonville, Lincoln, Normal, Peoria, and Springfield. The title of your book, Charles Ives Reconsidered. What needs to be reconsidered? We've talked a little bit about some of the impressions, but what are some others that, you know, people have written about and said, and that said, well, maybe we should think about it differently?
Great question. I think some of the things that I want to talk about in this book have to do with the way that Ives was initially received, the reception of his music, and the way that his music was thought of, including this idea that, for example, most of his music is experimental. Well, no, it's not. Actually, most of the music that has been played over the first half century or so perhaps is more experimental, but he wrote a tremendous number of tonal or more conservative works. And I wanted to kind of talk about what that means, the fact that he wrote works like Two Little Flowers in the 1920s at the same time that the Concord Sonata was circulating in its first publication. Why do we tend to focus on Concord Sonata instead of Two Little Flowers, or instead of In the Morning, or instead of some of these other more conservative works? I think it's connected to this image of Ives as the father of experimental music. If he's no longer completely experimental, then he's maybe not as exciting to people. I think that Ives has been used as a symbol for American composers of certain things, and what I wanted to do in this book was to talk about maybe what was being left out of that narrative or de-emphasized.
Just reading from the description of the book on the U of I Press website, it says, you take on the idolaters and the revisionists with equal vigor.
I think that was from a review, actually. I think that was from a review in the Gramophone.
Oh, it is, yes,
it
actually.
Is. Yes.
That's from The Wire.
The Wire,
yeah.
Yes. That was a fun review. Yeah, I don't know where that came from. But yes, definitely. There's a tendency to both to celebrate Ives just in this one particular way, that he broke all the rules of music, that he had no ties to the European tradition, that he never promoted his own music, that he simply lived this life of selling insurance during the day and writing his music at night and never wanting to find an audience. I think that's part of the hagiography of Ives, and it's part of the need that we have for Ives to be above and beyond all of these other things in music, including not being connected to European music. That's not true. He did actually promote his music a lot. Yes, he did work in insurance between 1902 and 1918. But even then, as I document in the book, there were many times where he tried to get performers interested in his music. He had the conductor Walter Damrosch read through part of a symphony. That didn't just happen. It happened because Ives was making those connections. He was trying to promote his music. He was trying to get people interested.
And what about the revisionists? What are the revisionists doing about Ives?
Well, I don't know what the revisionists are doing. I think I'm probably in that group, so I'm not quite sure how I'm taking on myself with vim and vigor. But anyway, it's interesting that there has been a movement to once again kind of look at things a little more critically, and to move beyond a stance of advocacy. I think what the person they're referring to probably by the revisionists is they're referring to Maynard Solomon, who wrote an article on Charles Ives in 1987 that suggested, and it's a very well-written article, it suggested that Ives could have faked the dates of his music, and that Ives, in fact, because he wasn't well-known between 1902 to 1918, but then he was better known in the 20s and much better known in the 30s, that he could have gone back and revised his works and said, well, this is a work from 1902, but actually he finished writing it in 1930. I think that's the revisionism. I don't agree with that. It doesn't hold up. It was a very controversial article when it came out in the 80s, but it hasn't actually held up at all. So that's probably what that review is referring to.
We haven't heard any of his orchestral music so far,
yeah.
Of which there's quite a bit, and probably it gets heard more than any of the other music, and
definitely.
Some of it, as you said, is a little more experimental. And some of the let's talk about some of the experiments as best we can for a lay audience.
Okay.
One of which is to have lots of different rhythms going on at the same time,
right.
And so it ends up sounding somewhat chaotic to most people, including people who are not lay people in the music business.
That's true.
What other sorts of things?
Well, polyrhythm, polymeter, having many meters going on at the same time, polytonality, having many keys at the same time. Many of those come from a very the real-life experience of music, of having one marching band marching at the same time that another marching band is going by. So you hear two tunes going. They're totally different tunes. One has one rhythm and one meter and one key, and the other one has a different key. And when you're standing in the middle hearing those marching bands walk around you, you're hearing two different pieces of music. Some of the things that Ives puts into his music are very funny. Again, the sense of humor that he has, the players and the marching bands getting mixed up and playing each other's music and getting lost. But he writes that into a symphony, for example. He writes that into the parts, so it's intentional, and it's trying to recreate the sense of amateur music making. There are a lot of other things, too, and some of them are kind of more reminiscent of the things that were happening in Europe, including music by Schoenberg and Stravinsky. He had a system of ordering pitches in 12 groups, which is not serialist, but it's kind of working with all 12 pitches at once, very much outside of any sense of tonality. So you really don't have a sense of a home key. He wrote one work that was all based on expanding intervals, which is the distance between two groups. He wrote part of it with just seconds, and then he wrote parts of it with just thirds, then parts of it with just fourths, and all the way up to an octave and all the way and back. These are ways that Ives really kind of worked against the sense of a solid home base, a tonal home base, the place that you always come back to. And many of his works really do counter that. On the other hand, there is a sense of tonality in many of the works that we're listening to today.
Including this next one from his Third yeah. Symphony, which is a wonderful piece, mm-hmm. which is heavily based on hymn tunes.
Very much so.
And as I think you'll hear in this second movement, it's called Children's Day. It starts with a good grounding and then kind of mm-hmm. wanders around.
Wanders
and
off, yeah.
As
comes a child
back.
Is, you know, known to do. And then comes back, fortunately.
Children's Day from the Third Symphony of Charles Ives. The Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam is led here by Michael Tilson Thomas on Live and Local. Some of the second movement, called Children's Day, from the Third Symphony, nicknamed The Camp Meeting by Charles Ives. Concertgebouw Orchestra was conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas. And really kind of a good example of many aspects of Ives' music, the use of hymn tunes, and he's just sort of piling them one on top of each other.
Yes, it's a way of creating a lot of energy, I think. But it's also, it has formal purposes, that all of those are being used as themes, and they're all going to be wrapped up together at the end.
And it's a wonderful symphony and really, really touching, especially
oh,
at the end.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful work, really.
Yeah, Third Symphony. So we're trying to sample as many pieces as we can squeeze in of Ives, leaning heavily on the more accessible ones sort
Definitely.
Of to indicate that this part of Ives is out there.
Absolutely.
My guest here on Live and Local is Gail McGee, author of Charles Ives Reconsidered. And how long ago did you write the book?
I finished writing it between about 2006. It went through revisions in 2007. It was published by the University of Illinois Press in 2008, and now it's just come out in paperback.
All right. And it's not very long, so if people want to, and there's lots of pictures.
Yes, there are. There are pictures.
Which is always good. And he's an interesting-looking guy, too. Mm-hmm. He sort of looks like you might expect from his music. I'm not sure what that means, but since I both know what he looks like and what his music sounds like, but they seem to go together. I did pull out another favorite piece of mine just for the heck of it, because this is, again, the fun side of Ives. And if I remember right, I haven't heard this piece through in quite a while. Isn't this one where he really does have these marching bands against each other?
Yes, that's right. Yes. That was an idea that he kept coming back to. And it has its origins in real life, that actually his father, George Ives, who directed these bands, he was fascinated with the effect of having multiple pieces of music going on at the same time. So he stood in the green in Danbury, where Ives grew up, and he had one marching band at one corner and one marching band at the other, and apparently he had them march towards him and cross. And George Ives, Charles Ives' father, stood in the middle listening to all of this. And that was actually, it was documented by someone else. It seemed like one of these tall tales, but it was really true. And Ives took that as a kernel of an idea and embedded it in many of his compositions, including this.
Wasn't George himself, besides that particular incident, he was kind of interested in musical experimentation. Am I remembering that right?
He was, and he was interested in things like the Dolby effect of how sound changes over space, that if you're listening to a train coming towards you and you hear it and then, you know, it sort of goes past you, and how that sound is different. He was interested in microtones with things like church bells. I don't think he was as systematic and scientific about it as Ives later made him out to be, in part because I think Ives wanted to respect his father's interests and curiosity, and he was maybe afraid that if he talked about them in a certain way that they would not be respected in this new sort of post-1900 professionalization of music making.
So we had this kind of image of an eccentric composer who's the son of an eccentric
music
father.
Maker. Yes, definitely. It definitely runs in the family.
Yeah. Well, here's the movement from three places in New England, which is in itself another one of these quintessentially American kind of things, because
Absolutely. He
bases all three movements on specific places, as the title implies. The how did they say it?
St. Gaudens? I've always said St. Gaudens.
That might be it.
Yeah.
In Boston Common, which is, I'm actually trying to picture where that is in there.
It's a statue to Colonel Robert Gould Shaw and his regiment that's in, I have been to that, but I don't know exactly where it is in Boston Common. You might know better than I do.
Well, I can't remember it. I've been in Boston Common many times. Colonel Shaw and his colored regiment is the subtitle of the movement. And then the last one is a pretty famous piece, the Housatonic at Stockbridge.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
Which is really difficult to picture what he had in mind when listening to the music. It's one of these kind of ethereal.
It's almost impressionistic,
yeah.
I think. It's the fog over the water, and it's, again, recalling many different parts of his life. It's recalling his memories of his father, who was a cornetist in the army, and that's placed into this. It's also recalling a moment on his honeymoon that he took a walk with his wife by the water and saw the mist sort of rising over the water. It's very evocative.
Mm. And here's the middle movement, which is unlike either the first or the last.
Yeah.
It's called Putnam's Camp, Reading, Connecticut, from three places in New England, also known as the first orchestral set by Charles Ives. Here's the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra on Live and Local. That breaks off into more ethereal sorts of things going on. Putnam's Camp, Reading, Connecticut, the middle of three places in New England of Charles Ives, the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We're talking with Gail McGee, author of Charles Ives Reconsidered, and talking about some of the ways in which he needs to be reconsidered, perhaps, but also sort of using this as an excuse to play some perhaps unexpected music of Charles Ives. This thing you've got next,
very
I didn't
fun.
Even know existed.
It's very fun. Well, it's taken from this CD. The initial recording is taken from a CD called Ives Plays Ives. And we heard that originally with the Alcotts. But what happened was that Ives had many recordings that he made between 1933 and 1943. He actually made the first recording in 1933 at Abbey Road Studios, very famous for other reasons. But this later group of recordings, they were issued in around 1974 as part of the centennial celebration when he would have turned 100. And Kronos Quartet became very interested in it, and they decided they'd love to do a duet with Ives. So what they did was they took this recording of Ives playing and singing his own song, the song is called They Are There, and they built a string quartet part around it. So it's really a fun composition.
So it's his music, but also Kronos's.
Yes. So he's playing the piano and he's singing, but Kronos is always playing.
So when was this recording made?
He made the recording in 1943. And this song was originally written for the first World War. It was called He Is There, and it's basically combining all of these battle tunes. It's a collage where you have Marching Through Georgia and Yankee Doodle and Star Spangled Banner and Over There, and he's just packing them in. I mean, you think the density has been all right. You should have to listen to this. He's just packing them in as much as he can. But he wrote He Is There for the First World War, and then in the Second World War, in 1942, he came back and revised it as They Are There. And then he recorded this piece in 1943, playing the piano and singing along with it. And I think you get a sense of Ives's dynamism in this. He was so energetic and had such a character.
Here's the Kronos Quartet and Charles Ives on Live and Local.
There's a time in many a life when it's doodle faces blessed, but our soldier boy will do their part that people can live in a people's free world. Shouting the little guy of freedom.
Love the way that Kronos in that recording includes the drop and pickup of the needle on the phonograph.
That's right. Yeah.
Charles Ives singing and playing his song They Are There with Kronos Quartet, sort of working things in and around there. I mean, that really sounds like, you know, the eccentric uncle down the road that people, you know, get together with just to have fun.
Exactly.
But that seems encapsulates a lot of things about him. It seems there.
Mm-hmm.
Gail McGee, author of Charles Ives Reconsidered from the University of Illinois Press. You can get it in paperback, recently out. And is it a fun book at all? I mean, are you able to pull out this, as somebody reads this, will they find any of the humor in the book, or is it really scholarly sounding?
No. I tried to write it so it would be accessible. I have to say I kept certain audiences in mind as I wrote this, and two people who reviewed it for me are my in-laws, Dick and Joyce McGee, and they're sort of the perfect audience. They read this when it was in manuscript form, and they know a lot about music in general, but they're not musicologists, and I wanted to know if it worked for them as a book. So they were great in giving me feedback and support while I wrote this.
You have a website you'd like to
I would.
Mention.
Yes. I'm the president of the Charles Ives Society, which works to promote Ives's music. And if you're on Facebook, I would love you to check out the Ives Society and like us. We're on Facebook.com/Charles Ives. That's all you have to do. Look up Charles Ives Society on Facebook.
And then like you.
And then, well, yes. But it also gives information on upcoming performances that are happening around and publications and news events that are related to Ives.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Gail, for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin. It's fun.
Gail McGee on Live and Local, Charles Ives. Interesting character. Fun to go out and hear. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WYNL-FM and HD1 and HD2 Urbana, with translators W266AF Urbana and W293AF Danville. And we have support today from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the series collected to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from noon to 4 in the Bouvon's Tasting Room. More information is at thecorkscrew.com. Gail mentioned earlier that Charles Ives was an organist for some of his early years, including while he was at Yale. And this piece is interesting because it was apparently improvised by him at the organ, and he eventually later on wrote it down. We were only going to hear just a fragment of it, but it's an awful lot of fun. I thought it might be good for this quintessentially American holiday of Thanksgiving, which is coming up. It's this called Variations on America. We're hearing Simon Preston at the Great Organ of the Methuen Memorial Music Hall and Live and Local.